Let's get started with the failed assassination of Donald Trump. After more than 60 years, we had the assassination of JFK in 1963. And right now we're witnessing that they're trying to kill Donald Trump. In your opinion, what's going on right now in the United States?
Well, there is a long tradition of political assassination in the United States. In 1968, 5 years after JFK, RFK, his brother, Martin Luther King, were both assassinated. And, you know, we have a country which is deeply polarized. There are 44 million AR-15s, assault rifles, in the United States. That's more than the population of most countries in the Western Hemisphere. Something like this can easily happen. Now, the question is, what are the consequences? And I think the consequences are a boost to Mr. Trump politically, because he was being accused of being a source of violence, political violence. Now he's seen as the victim of political violence. So this boosts his campaign and his likelihood of winning the presidency at the very moment that Mr. Biden continues to demonstrate his decrepitude, his age. Well, I'm the same age as he, but he does not seem to have command of facts or syntax. There's some real questions about how much he really is engaged in running either the country or, as he put it, the world. He said he was running the world, which may explain why the world is such a mess if he's really doing it.
Yeah. And right after this, we've learned that CNN came with a new story talking about maybe Iran is behind this attack on Donald Trump. And Fareed Zakaria, he invited the foreign minister of Iran to his program on CNN. He was asking him, did you do that? He said, no, we are not going to do that. We're going to do it legally, not assassinating.
Well, that's what I say. There are so many suspicions. Many of them focus on domestic conspiracies. Many of them focus on foreign alleged enemies or designated enemies. I don't believe Iran would have done anything like that. It has too much to lose if it does that sort of thing. It has already experienced the dangers of having its own officials assassinated. Mr. General Soleimani as a case in point. I don't think this is the kind of game that Iran would want to play.
And when you look at Donald Trump's decision in choosing Senator Vance as his vice president, in your opinion, what are the implications of this decision?
Well, it's not entirely clear, because Mr. Vance, of course, at one point was denouncing Mr. Trump as the American Hitler and said a lot of nasty things about him. Apparently, he has repented and he is now saved in the eyes of Mr. Trump, his God, and he is willing to serve with Mr. Trump at age 39, almost 40. He is young. He has a big future in American politics. He has an interesting, quite appealing background. Many people don't trust him, but he has the opportunity to establish trust. There are several disturbing aspects of this. He has said that he would have supported the January 6th effort to void the 2020 election, which is, for someone with a law degree, quite an extraordinary statement to make. In foreign policy, he shares Mr. Trump's opposition to the war in Ukraine. I don't know what his position is on the genocide in Palestine, but that just may be my ignorance. At any rate, he does seem to be more in line with the advocates of more restrained foreign policy than otherwise. So we'll see. Domestically, you know, he comes from a very impoverished background, but he's now aligned himself thoroughly with the plutocracy. So whether he will be someone who advocates a more just distribution of opportunities and income than we currently have. In any event, given what is happening and the inability of the Democrats to organize themselves to produce a more viable candidate in these elections, Mr. Vance is very likely to be the next vice president. And given Mr. Trump's age other issues, even if he is not the subject of further assassination attempts, Mr. Vance may very well be our president.
With what has happened in the NATO summit, do you think that the Ukraine project is fading away from the background of NATO and their way of thinking?
Well, I think there are a lot of politicians in Europe and the United States who have so committed themselves to the war in Ukraine that they cannot conceive of anything other than war. And you see this in the reaction to Mr. Orban, seconded by Mr. Fico in Slovakia, who is attempting to restart great power dialogue and a dialogue between Russia and Ukraine. He went first to Kyiv, then to Moscow, then to Beijing, and then he visited Mr. Trump, whom he has always had a good relationship with, and who he clearly believes is very likely to be the next American president. Mr. Trump said that Mr. Orban had a constructive conversation with him. Mr. Orban said Mr. Trump had a detailed plan in mind for peace in Ukraine. So from this perspective, Mr. Trump is a very desirable new feature of American politics. Unfortunately, he brings other things with him, not simply a plan for peace in Ukraine.
But it seems that Orban is getting more and more isolated in the European Union, that they're trying to do each and everything to isolate him. How do you see the situation of Orban and his ilk, these people who are thinking that the conflict in Ukraine is not working for Europe?
Well, he is obviously an outlier, and he is being subjected to efforts to disempower him and ostracize him. He obviously anticipated this. My sense of Mr. Orban is that he is a strong-willed person. He has his own strong convictions. He is a Hungarian nationalist. Earlier, he was accused of being anti-Russian. Now he's accused of being pro-Russian. I think he's pro-Hungarian. Hungary is a frontline state. Hungary has a history in the 20th century of being forced into alliance with Nazi Germany and then forced into alliance with the Soviet Union. And it is very acutely aware of the need for peace in Europe. And I think that is Mr. Orban's objective. And it's rather sad that instead of people exploring with him how that might be achieved, they are trying to punish him for advocating dialogue and peace. I think he's doing something brave, something necessary. I don't think he's going to be very successful, I'm afraid, but he's certainly making an effort that's worth making.
Do you think that in this NATO summit, we have been witnessing that it seems that the policy is changing, shifting from Russia to China, getting more aggressive toward China by inviting Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and South Korea?
There is an effort, of course, to globalize NATO, in effect, as an auxiliary backup force for the United States. And the United States at the moment is obsessed with China. And clearly the Chinese have understood from the very beginning that if the American and NATO effort to subdue Russia were successful, we would then turn to try to subdue China. So it is, in my view, to accuse the Chinese of enabling the continuation of this war when the United States, Britain, and other countries in NATO have been so vigorously supporting the continuation of the war and blocking any effort at a peaceful settlement of it through negotiations, as we did in April of 2022 with the infamous Boris Johnson visit to Kyiv to stop Kyiv from ratifying the treaty its negotiators had initialed with the Russian negotiators in Istanbul. So I think the effort to enlist Europeans in support of an obsessive American desire to put China down is partially successful, but not entirely. And it's very notable that some European countries, in fact, all of them to one extent or the other, have tried to avoid being entangled in the US-China rivalry to the extent they can. Mr. Orban, in particular, has reached out to China and with some benefits for his country in the form of investments in automobile plants and other items that will enable the Chinese to continue to compete in the European market. So this is a little bit complicated, but I'd finally note that there is no prospect that Europeans can contribute anything significant at all to the forces arrayed against China in Pacific Asia. The one exception might be the British contribution to the Australian nuclear submarine program, which, however, displaced a far more economical and, in my view, sensible submarine program with France. It was not nuclear, it was conventional. The reason for nuclear submarines for Australia, which is quite far from the South China Sea and Taiwan, is to try to draw Australia into any fight between the United States and China. So I think Europeans may symbolically support the United States in this case and issue fierce statements have their own reasons for wanting to establish cooperative relations with major countries like Japan, but it is not militarily or strategically significant. Its main result is to complicate their relations with China, which continues to rise, continues to excel in science and technology, and is very ever more competitive. Productivity per worker in China continues to rise very rapidly, whereas it hardly rises at all in Europe, or in, I'm sorry to say, in Brazil, for that matter.
Yeah. Do you think that this joint military exercises that Russia and China are having in the South China Sea, what's the message, what's the political message out of this joint exercises when they're doing this? In your opinion, they're sending some sort of message to NATO?
Not to NATO, but to the United States. And the message is not hard to understand. Let us remember that after the United States and NATO dropped objections to the Ukrainians firing great distances into Russia with missiles and artillery shells, that Russia announced it would not escalate to the nuclear level, but it would begin to arm the enemies of the United States and others arrayed against it in Ukraine. And Mr. Putin then went to North Korea and embraced the North Korean regime in a way that Russia had not, and has even offered assistance to the North Korean ICBM program. So he then went to Vietnam, where in some ways he was reestablishing a relationship with Vietnam that assists Vietnam in balancing on all fronts against China, against the United States, and so forth. So this is a Russian game in which the Russians have openly said that they will side pretty much with any enemy of the United States. So when you see a joint exercise near Vietnam in the South China Sea, what the message is that if there is a war between the United States and China, Russia may very well come in on the Chinese side. Does not have a commitment to do that, but the clear implication is, in the event of a war over Taiwan, for example, Russia would provide assistance to China, either directly, or I would say more likely indirectly, through intelligence support, signals intelligence, satellites, and so forth, or possibly even through the creation of a diversion somewhere that would draw U.S. forces away from the Chinese front. That's the message.
And we remember when the conflict in Ukraine started, one of the first countries to get in line with the United States on their policy toward Russia was the United Kingdom in European Union. Right now, there is an article in Bloomberg, George Robertson, the defense advisor to new British Prime Minister Starmer. He says that China poses a deadly threat to the United Kingdom. How we can draw such a conclusion?
Well, I think this is part of a broad effort within Europe, and particularly now in Britain, to restore increases in defense spending and armaments. Britain is not a significant military power in many ways. I remember hearing, I don't remember who said it, but it might have been John Mearsheimer, that the British Army is now the same size as it was in 1716. That is before Britain became an imperial power, when it was a European power of some consequence, but not the major power in Europe. So the British have a reason to want to reestablish their military power to some extent, and China is a convenient red flag to wave in front of the bull. So of course, as you know, when the torero lifts the cape in front of the bull, there's nothing behind it. He's just trying to get the bull to move. So I'm not sure how seriously we should take this advisor to the prime minister. I think the Europeans, for their part, continue to hedge against the possibility of an American abandonment, now quite realistic in terms of Ukraine. If Mr. Trump is elected, he's very unlikely to follow the policies the Biden administration has followed. And perhaps Britain is thinking in the same terms. You find an excuse to build up your armed forces for your own defense, and you justify it in terms of a common effort against an enemy of the United States. But really what you're doing is acquiring a greater ability to act independently of the United States. This, I would say, is the strategy that Japan has followed. Every improvement in Japanese armaments, every extension of Japanese defense policy has been justified in terms of making a greater contribution to the US-Japan alliance. But every such move has had the effect of enlarging the possibility that Japan could go on its own if it felt that was necessary. Something similar may be going on with some of the European countries which are increasing their defense budgets. I think that's clearly the case in Poland, which is now one of the most significant military powers in Europe and is spending over 4% of its GDP on the military. Whether it's true of Britain or not, I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised. There is a reason that perfidious Albion has that name.
If we were to mention three important events that has led to the conflict in Ukraine, would be the ABM treaty and NATO expansion and INF treaty. INF treaty was done by the Trump administration, and he put tremendous sanctions on Russia when he was in office. In your opinion, how powerful Trump would be if he wins 2024 to bring an end to the conflict in Ukraine? He said 24 hours, which is not logical. But what's your take on his?
He could certainly present an ultimatum in a 24-hour period, probably to Mr. Zelensky or whoever is running Ukraine at the time. Because Mr. Zelensky is the prisoner of right-wing forces in Ukraine as well as of his foreign patrons. I don't envy him his position. So Mr. Trump might actually present an ultimatum to Ukraine, to Russia, you know, put up or shut up. That would be typical of the sort of negotiating style he perfected in the New York real estate market, which is a very dishonest and difficult, tough market indeed. So I wouldn't rule that out, but I think Mr. Orban, if he's doing nothing else, is laying a basis for some kind of peace process. I note that he has the support, clear support of the Chinese, expressed most recently by the foreign minister, Wang Yi. He clearly has some understanding as well as differences with Mr. Putin and with Sergei Lavrov, who arranged his meeting with Mr. Putin. I don't know to what extent he and Zelensky have reached common understandings. It's clear that he does not have the backing of Michel or others in the EU, von der Leyen and so on, but these are early days. He's at the very beginning of his six-month rotational presidency, and events are unfolding on the ground.
Do you think that Trump gonna learn from his first term in order to not let these neocons capturing his administration?
Well, I think that's a very important point. He has grumbled and complained about the deep state resisting his policy preferences. But to some extent, he was frustrated by the very people he appointed to office. The one resounding success in his terms of his presidency was to pack the Supreme Court with reactionary radicals. And we see the radical reactionary decisions that they now make. But within the executive branch, he was not able very often to make the things he wanted to happen. Think, for example, of his effort to extract us from Afghanistan and from Syria. Both were essentially frustrated, partly by his own people partly by the bureaucracy. So I suspect he has learned a lesson. But the crucial point here is that it makes a huge difference who he brings into office with him. For example, Robert Lighthizer, who is an apostle of tariffs of the sort that McKinley imposed before the U.S. income tax became possible, and of the tariffs, the Smoot-Hawley tariff that basically supercharged the Depression, the Great Depression of the 1930s. He had been rumored to be Treasury Secretary. If he is Treasury Secretary and he implements his philosophy, most economists that I know believe this would be gravely damaging, not only to the American economy, but to the global economy. In fact, depending on the level of tariffs put in and other restrictions, some people have said it could cause the equivalent of a stroke, a heart attack in the global economy, and put us back into the sort of depression we have not seen for 90 years. So if he brings in Jamie Dimon, I'm not a great fan of Jamie Dimon, but he is a very different figure, much more cosmopolitan, much more savvy economically. Mr. Lighthizer is a lawyer. He's not an economist. Mr. Dimon is a skilled practitioner of business and banking. And that would have a very different result. If he brought back somebody in the nature of Pompeo, he will not bring back Pompeo. But had he brought, if he did, in the foreign affairs area, we would have a very different posture than we now do. So I think the question that is imponderable, we cannot answer it. It's clearly Mr. Trump sees the merit of disengaging from the front line in Europe, where we have been for 76 years, 75 years anyway. And he would like to reduce the defense burden that we have and insist that Europeans and Asians, for that matter, take greater responsibility for their own defense. You know, it is really, in his view, and I think quite reasonable to say this, and after all this time, it is anomalous for the United States to still be carrying the burden of defending Europe or Japan, because they are now rich and they are powerful and they have the capability to do a great deal more in their own behalf than they have been doing. Similarly, I know Mr. Trump has said recently that he does not believe it's worth it for the United States to take the risks associated with defending Taiwan, and that Taiwan should defend itself. And to the extent the United States is involved, Taiwan, which is also now a wealthy, successful society, should be prepared to pay for that. So this is a very different mentality than anything that we have seen since the end of World War II. It's very disturbing to those who are wedded to the unipolar world or the Cold War division of the world into contending blocks. But it is not irrational. It is not without a basis. And the real question is, will he implement this at all? And if he does, will he implement it diplomatically, gradually, so as to reduce the shock and avoid destabilizing things? Or will he act impetuously and risk destabilizing not just Europe, but Asia? We don't know.
In your opinion, with what's going on right now in Gaza, how do you see the possibility of Israel attacking Hezbollah? Recently, we've learned that in Lebanon, they're talking about that Shia, Sunni, Christians, all of them are united. If Israel wants to attack, they are all united to fight against Israel. But how serious is this rhetoric, in your opinion?
I think it's quite serious. Lebanon has its own nationalism. Of course, we also have to recognize that in addition to Hezbollah's formidable missile force, which is said to number over 100,000, many of them quite accurate, with significant range, and quite capable of blanketing Israel from south to north with rocket fire, supplemented by artillery fire on the border, and probably by an intifada, an uprising among Palestinians who are now desperate. In addition to this, we have heard from Iran that if this Israel attacks Lebanon in this manner, Iran will be full bore with Lebanon. Now, what that means, whether Iran is sincere or not, I don't know. Sincerity is rare enough in the Middle East to be very valued. The less common something is, the higher the value on it, and insincerity is much more normal in the Middle East than sincerity. So I don't know whether to believe Iran or not, but I do believe that Iran would be highly supportive. And so Israel, if it attacks Lebanon, in my opinion, will take on risks that could end in the destruction of the Zionist experiment. Because I don't think many Israelis will want to live in a region where they no longer enjoy military supremacy and protection from the hatred that they have built in their neighbors. There is no country in the region, even those with whom Israel has normalized relations formally, like Egypt or Jordan or the Abraham Accords, there is no country in the region that has anything but deep dislike, even hatred, for the Zionist state. I think this is a failure of Israeli policy. And Mr. Netanyahu, who is now deeply unpopular in Israel, I think should take a great deal of the responsibility for this failure to make peace and to establish friendship with neighbors. Israel has followed a policy of pursuing security purely by military means, by coercive means. But in the long run, this is not a viable strategy for any country, even one as talented and at the moment backed by foreign powers as Israel is. There is always the example of the Christian kingdoms of Jerusalem, which, almost 1,000 years ago, less than that, 800, 900 years ago, established themselves in Palestine, lasted for decades or 100 years, and then folded because they made the very same mistake that the Muslims made in Spain. Namely, they did not take their enemies respectfully seriously. They never made peace. And in a slow grind, the case of Spain took 800 years. You ended up with no Muslims, or for that matter, Jews, still in the Iberian Peninsula. So some Israelis I've spoken with, who are very far-sighted, wise people, understand the risks that Israel takes by putting all of its eggs in the military basket. But I'm sorry to say that Mr. Netanyahu, unlike his own military, who are quite sensible about this, just does not understand that, nor, I'm afraid, do most Israelis.
With what has happened, we had an article in The Lancet. They were talking about the number of casualties, more than 186,000 Gazans were killed. They're talking about this. And at least we had some sort of expectation that after this article coming out, the Israelis would come down a little bit. But it doesn't seem that they're just continuing the same manner that they have been doing during more than 9 months of this conflict.
They are being enabled by the United States, primarily. They don't believe they're taking any risks. They believe that the actions of the international courts can be blocked by the United States and Great Britain. Therefore, they are exempt from international law, and there will be no consequences for the savagery, the barbarism that they are displaying. I think they're wrong. I think this the risks are considerable in terms of international law, and I believe Israel has made itself the target of global hatred opprobrium, and it will not soon recover from this. It is ironic, Mr. Biden the other day said that, you know, Israel was essential to the safety of the world's Jews. In fact, Israel is the only real menace to the safety of the world's Jews, since its behavior stimulates hatred of Jews. I think wrongly. I don't consider the Israelis to be serious Jews. I think Zionism is the negation of the religion of Judaism, which is a humane religion distinguished by scholarship and ethical reasoning, which I don't see much evidence of, except in the area of military matters and high tech in Israel. So I think this is a case where Israel thinks it has nothing to lose. By the way, the Lancet's figures seem to me to be quite reasonable. I mean, we've had 9 months of incredibly intensive bombing, plus tanks on the ground, snipers shooting randomly, apparently shooting at anything that moves, no rules of engagement that pay any attention to the laws of war. So Israel has learned, which had claimed the mantle of the world's most moral army, now has the mantle of the world's most criminal army. And that will count. I think the number of casualties on the Palestinian side may well be even more than what the Lancet estimated. When the Palestinian health ministry reported deaths, it did so on the basis of verified identities. It counted people who were known to have died. But the savagery, the mayhem, the destruction of buildings and infrastructure has gone well beyond the point when individuals can be counted. And in fact, the health ministry itself has lost most of its personnel, because of course they were politically associated with Hamas. And therefore Israel regarded them, even though they were civilians, as legitimate targets. So I think the death toll probably is around 9 or 10% of the Palestinian population in Gaza. That is genocide, unquestionably. I note that Mr. Netanyahu not only does not acknowledge this, but seems at the same time to be preparing for the resettlement of Gaza by Zionist settlers. And the dismemberment of Gaza, its separation into different zones, all of which would be controlled by Israel, which raises a question. When did the world ever acknowledge that Gaza was under Israeli sovereignty? Do the Palestinians have no voice in their own future? Is that future to be determined by the enemies of Hamas, Israel, and the United States? If Hamas wins elections, does that count for nothing? After all, the Israeli state was founded by terror. other states have been founded in terror as well, including the United States. Our War of Independence was a very savage thing, almost as much a civil war as it was a war against the British. So if you win the war, if you don't win the war, you're a terrorist. If you do win the war, you're a national hero. And I think we need to take account of the fact that the Palestinians not only have legitimate grievances with the extremely cruel way in which they have been treated, but they also have a voice, and they have the right to elect and choose their own leaders and the political parties that represent them. And they should be afforded that right. Nobody should say, you can't have this or that group there. Nobody did that in the case of Israel. Nobody should do that in the case of Palestinian self-determination.
Just to wrap up this session, when you saw this article coming out of Haaretz talking about reporting that on October 7th, Israeli army was killing Israelis in order not to be captured by Hamas, when the reality gonna hit the public opinion in Israel, just bring them to some sort of sanity, and what the Netanyahu administration is doing?
Well, I thought from the beginning that this was the case, that the Hannibal Directive, which dictates that Israelis who are in danger of becoming hostages should be killed rather than become the subject of bargaining with the Palestinians, whoever they are. I note that some courageous journalists, Aaron Maté, Max Blumenthal, come to mind, but others as well, reported this and were immediately attacked by all of the usual Zionist attack dogs for making up fictions. It's now very well established that in fact everything they reported was correct. The stories of atrocities by the Palestinians, some of them probably are true, but most of them, and the more extreme such stories, clearly were not. They were made up. So we're dealing with a situation in which the information warfare that has characterized Israeli policy. Israel has a Ministry of Strategic Affairs that conducts hasbara, which is the Hebrew word for explanation or propaganda, if you will, excuses. There's nobody better in the world at this, and either covering up their own misdeeds or asserting that others have done things that are sinful and worthy of punishment. The one thing you can now be sure of, we have learned in watching Israel over the last 9 months, is that when Israel accuses someone else of having done something horrible, it's almost certainly because Israel itself has done that. And this one of the casualties of this war. It is said that the first casualty of war is the truth. In this war, the casualty is any credibility for either Israel or, I'm sorry to say, the spokespeople for the United States, who have lined up with Israel in an unconscionable manner that is deeply embarrassing to me and to many others.